Hey everyone, and welcome back to True Crime Cases. I'm your host, Allison Mendes, and today I'm going to tell you the story of a killer who preyed on young men for 4 years before the police would catch up to him. This is the story of Dennis Nilsen. Dennis Andrew Nilsen was born on November 23rd in 1945 in Fraserburgh, Aberdeenshire. He was the second of three children born to Elizabeth Duthie White and Olav Magnus Nilsen. Olav was a Norwegian soldier who had traveled to Scotland in 1940 as part of the Free Norwegian Forces following the German occupation of Norway. After dating for only a short amount of time, Olav and Elizabeth got married in May of 1942, at which point they move into Elizabeth's parents' home. Olav and Elizabeth had a less than perfect marriage, possibly even what you might call a difficult one. Olav was said to not take the marriage very seriously at all. He spent his time preoccupied with his duties with the Free Norwegian Forces, with little effort to help spend time with Elizabeth or find the two a new home where they could have some privacy away from Elizabeth's parents. After the birth of their third child, Elizabeth had come to the conclusion that she had, quote, rushed into marriage without thinking, and in 1948, the couple got a divorce. Elizabeth and her three children remained with her parents, who were supportive of the divorce. They never really approved of Olav or the marriage in the first place, so they were supportive of that. Nilsen was said to be an adventurous child that kept to himself for the most part. He was shy. He said his earliest childhood memories were of picnics in the Scottish countryside with his family and going on long walks with his grandfather, who he was particularly close to. His brother Olav Jr. and his sister Sylvia occasionally joined Nilsen and his grandfather on these walks, and Nilsen would later refer to his grandfather as his great hero and protector, saying that when his grandfather was away at sea, his grandfather was a fisherman, that his life would be empty for me until he returned. That's a quote from him. By 1951, Nilsen's grandfather's health was deteriorating, and sadly, on October 31st of 1951, while he was at sea working, his grandfather died of a heart attack at the age of 62. His grandfather was returned home to be buried, and the funeral would be a very profound moment in Nilsen's life, and it would shape the direction of his life. He would later refer to it as a very distinct moment that he remembers in his childhood. He said that his mother asked him if he would like to see his grandfather, and when he replied that he did, his mom took him in to see his grandfather's open coffin, and she told young Nilsen that his grandfather was sleeping and that he had gone to a better place. And later he reflects back on this, knowing that his grandfather was dead and seeing a dead body for the first time. And this is going to come into play a lot later on in Nilsen's life. Now, in the years following his grandfather's death, Nilsen became even more self-isolating and even more withdrawn, often preferring to be alone. He didn't want to participate in any family activities, and he rejected any sort of affection that any of his adult family members would try to show him. Nilsen would grow to resent his older brother, Olav Jr., for what he saw as an unfair amount of attention that Olav got over him And because of this, he kind of grew closer with his younger sister, Sylvia, and bonded more to her. And at this point, he was the closest to Sylvia out of anyone in the family. In 1954, Nilsson's mother moves herself and her three children out of her parents' home and into a flat. And she would later get married to a man named Andrew Scott, who she will later have four additional children with him. And they move the entire family to Strichen, I hope I'm saying that right, in 1955. And Nilsson initially resented Andrew and thinks that he's kind of an unfair, stricter disciplinarian. But eventually this, I think, gives him a little bit of structure, and he eventually comes to respect Andrew. Now, when Nilsson hits puberty, he begins to struggle a lot with his sexuality. He discovers that he is gay, and he said that when he discovered this, he was very confused, and he was very ashamed, and he kept his sexuality hidden from his family members and the few friends that he did have at this point. He said he found that the boys he was attracted to had similar facial features to his little sister Sylvia, and that he thought that maybe his attraction to these boys was more of a manifestation of the love he felt for his sister rather than him actually being attracted to other boys. One night, in what he called an attempt to gain clarity on the situation, Nilsson said that he fondled both his little sister Sylvia and his older brother Olav Jr. while they were sleeping, hoping to kind of know which one aroused him more and maybe have clarity on his sexual, you know, his sexuality, I guess. But Olav Jr. ends up waking up, and after that night, he obviously had some strong suspicions that his brother was gay, and this would be the beginning of him and his brother even being divided further, with Olav Jr. bullying him a lot. And I read that he called him a hen in public, which is just kind of the Scottish way of calling someone a girl. He would call him that in public and around his friends. And it was just, you know, bullying, and just didn't create any sort of good relationship between him and his brother. Nilsson says that life in Strichen after this starts happening becomes increasingly oppressive. Little career opportunities there, and he said he couldn't really find anything that was entertaining for him. Nilsson says that although he respected the effort of his parents to provide for their family, that he did begin to resent being the poor kid around all of his friends and his peers, saying that although his parents provided for them, that he didn't really feel like they had any desire to better their lives or elevate their lives in any way, or the lives of their children. And because he felt this shame over, you know, the class that they were in and that they were, you know, poor, Nilsson rarely invited any friends over to the family house, and he just really wanted an escape from Strichen and from the poverty that he'd been raised in. And at the age of 14, Nilsson joins the Army Cadet Force, hoping that the British Army would be just the escape that he was so desperate for. Now, Nilsson had been an above average student, specifically when it came to history and art. He did really well in his schooling, other than when it came to more of the physical activities. Nilsson was not known to be particularly athletic or anything like that. He graduated school in 1961 when he was 14 and got a job at a canning factory while he decided what he wanted to do with his life. And after less than a month at the factory, this is when Nilsson informs his mom that he is planning on joining the army, and he was planning on training to be a chef in the army. Now, Nilsson passes the entrance exam and was officially notified that he was to enlist for 9 years of service in September of 1961. He quickly began his training with the Army Catering Corps, And that was at St. Omer Barracks in Aldershot, Hampshire. And he quickly began to excel in his army duties almost immediately. He would later look back on these 3 years of training at Aldershot, and he would call them the happiest of his life. Now, while stationed in Aldershot for his army training, Nilsson kept his sexuality hidden from his colleagues. He often opted to shower alone in the bathroom rather than in the group showers where the rest of the men would bathe. He said that he was afraid if he showered with the rest of the men that he would get an erection in front of them, and thus his sexuality would be exposed. This was a big concern for him, so he stuck to himself when it came to that kind of stuff. Now, halfway through 1964, Nilsson passes his initial catering exam, and he was assigned to the 1st Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in Osnabrück, West Germany. I know I didn't pronounce that right, and I'm sorry. This is where he served as a private, so he just got out of training. Throughout this deployment, Nilsson really began drinking much more regularly, and you might even say heavily. His colleagues would say that Nilsson drank for what they thought was to be more social, because like we mentioned before, Nilsson was shy and a little bit more reserved and stuck to himself. One night, Nilsson and a German boy drank to the point that Nilsson passed out on the floor of the boy's apartment. And when Nilsson woke up, although he did remember enough to know that there was no sexual activity that had occurred the night before, this still did fuel his sexual fantasies, which he had obviously been repressing quite a bit. And these sexual fantasies did include his partner being a younger, slender male, being completely submissive to him. And I'm just going to do a trigger warning right here. This is if you haven't heard of this case, there is like necrophilia and some other things. I am going to describe all of it. So if that's not something you want to hear, you might not want to continue. There's a lot more backstory that we're going to get into right now before that happens. And I'll do another trigger warning, but I do want to let you guys know. So eventually, these sexual fantasies would escalate to his partner not just being submissive, but being unconscious or even deceased. On several occasions, Nilsson said he would pretend to be more drunk than he actually was when he went out drinking with his colleagues, in the hopes that maybe one of them would take advantage sexually of him being unconscious. Since this was part of his fantasy. After serving 2 years in West Germany, Nilsson returned to Aldershot, where he passed his final catering exam, and he was deployed to serve as a cook for the British Army in Norway. And after Norway, Nilsson was deployed to the state of Aden, where he served as a cook. This is in 1967. This deployment is much more dangerous than the deployments that Nilsson has been on before. And he would later recall losing a lot of the men that he worked with in ambushes on their way back to the barracks and a lot of stuff like that. Nilsson himself was even kidnapped at one point by an Arab taxi driver, he said, and he was stuffed into the trunk of the taxi. When the driver attempted to, you know, pull over and drag Nilsson from the trunk of the car, Nilsson luckily grabbed a jack handle and beat the driver unconscious and placed the driver in the trunk, and he was able to escape. I don't know how lucky that was for everyone that would later become his victim. Maybe this story would have been a lot better if we had just done away with him there, but unfortunately that's not the case. Unlike his previous postings that he had, Nilsson also had his own room in Aden. This led to his sexual fantasies only escalating even further. He found his fantasy of a submissive or deceased partner was unfulfilled, and he would compensate for this by placing a mirror in front of his bed so that he could only see his body and not his head, so that his head was out of view. And he would imagine himself engaging in sex with another man that was unconscious or completely submissive. And Nilsson would later refer to this strategy as him splitting his personality. He would imagine himself being both the submissive and the dominant partner in these scenarios. Now, once Nilsson's deployment in Aden was done, he returned to the UK, where he was assigned to serve with the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders in Plymouth, Devon. He served here for 1 year before he was transferred to Cyprus in 1969. Just a few months after that, he would be reassigned to West Berlin. And Nilsson was then selected to cook for the Queen's Royal Guard. Then in January of 1971, he was reassigned to the Shetland Islands, which would be his last posting with the military. He would retire at the rank of corporal after 11 years of service in October of 1972. Now, after leaving the military in October, Nilsson moved back in with his family while he decided what his next move would be. He would only spend 3 short months here, and he said that his mom expressed quite often her concern for the lack of female relationships that Nilsson had previously in his life and currently. One night, Nilsson accompanied his older brother, Olav Jr., and his sister-in-law with another couple to watch a documentary about gay men. And while his family and friends poked fun at the documentary and obviously did not take it very seriously, Nilsson was adamantly defending gay rights. And after a fight broke out between Olav Jr. and Nilsson, his brother went back to his mom and informed her that Nilsson was gay. Nilsson never spoke to his brother again after this, and he would only maintain contact with the rest of his family through letters, and even this would be very sporadic. He left in December of 1972, and this is when he decided to join the Metropolitan Police in London. In April of 1973, Nilsson completed his training to become a police officer, and he was posted to Willesden Green. I'm so sorry if I'm pronouncing all of these wrong. I'm looking them up and it's just difficult. While Nilsson didn't made a lot of arrests, he never had to physically subdue anybody. Nilsson said that he enjoyed the work, but that he missed the comradeship of being in the army. Nilsson began drinking alone at night a lot during this time. It's the summer and fall of 1973, and Nilsson begins frequenting gay pubs and having a lot of casual sexual encounters with men. He later would refer to these encounters as, quote, soul-destroying, and that it was a vain search for inner peace when all that he really was searching for was a lasting relationship. Now, after he does have a failed relationship and the death of his father, whom he had little contact with, but it's still apparent, Nilsson decided that his personal life was conflicting with his profession. And in December of 1973, Nilsson resigned from the police force. Now, between December of 1973 and May of 1974, Nilsson worked sporadically as a security guard, but eventually he found a more stable and consistent job as a civil servant, where his role was to find employment for unskilled workers. At work, Nilsson was referred to as quiet but conscientious, and he was active in the trade union movement. His attendance was mediocre, but he did volunteer a lot to work overtime. In 1979, Nilsen was promoted to executive officer, and just a few years later, in 1982, he was promoted again to executive officer with additional supervisory responsibilities, and he was transferred to another work site in Kentish Town, where he would remain employed until his arrest. Now we're going to start getting into the murders. So just another trigger warning, this is where things are going to get a little bit more descriptive. I'm just letting you know ahead of time. In November of 1975, Nilsen met 20-year-old David Galichan outside of a pub where he was being threatened by two other men. Nilsen stepped in between the altercation, and he and Galichan went back to his room in the Cricklewood district of North London. The two spent the night drinking and getting to know one another, and Nilsen learned that Galichan had recently moved to London from Somerset and that he was gay, unemployed, and living in a hostel. And the next morning, the two agreed to find a larger home and move in together as roommates. Nilsen didn't waste any time, and he immediately began looking at places. And within a few days, he found a ground floor flat at 195 Melrose Avenue in Cricklewood, which they quickly decided to move into. Prior to moving in, Nilsen negotiated with the property's landlord, and they came to an agreement that only Nilsen and Galichan would have access to the garden that was at the rear of the property. Now, after moving into the flat, Nilsen quickly realized the lack of professional ambition that Galichan had, and Nilsen pretty much immediately took over the role of the main breadwinner in the relationship. While Nilsen was sexually attracted to Galichan, he would go back and say that the two rarely had sex. And within just a year of moving in together, the two were already sleeping in separate beds. And at one point, they even began bringing home their own sexual partners. The pair began arguing more frequently by 1976. And in May of 1977, the two had a more heated argument that resulted in Nilsen demanding that Galichan leave the residence. And over the next year and a half after that, Nilsen had a lot of flings with several young men, but none of them revolved into a serious relationship at all. No one else moved into the flat. And by late 1978, after numerous failed relationships, Nilsen said that he viewed himself as unfit to live with. And he spent a lot of his time devoted to work and his nights alone drinking and listening to music. On December 30th of 1978, Nilsen met 14-year-old Stephen Holmes in the Cricklewood Arms pub. After Stephen had tried to purchase alcohol but was unsuccessful because he was underaged, Nilsen said he had been drinking heavily in his flat earlier that evening, and that he had left the flat seeking company at, quote, any means possible. Nilsen invited Stephen back to his flat to have a few drinks and listen to some music with him, and Stephen accepted the invite. He went back to Nilsen's flat, and the two drank heavily and fell asleep. When Nilsen woke up the next morning, he said he was afraid to wake Stephen up because he was afraid that Stephen would leave him. And after touching Stephen while he was sleeping, Nilsen decided that he wanted Stephen to stay with him over the new year, quote, whether he wanted to or not. At this point, Nilsen goes and gets a necktie. He straddles Stephen and strangles him to the point of unconsciousness. After that, he proceeds to drown Stephen in a bucket of water. Nilsen then washed Stephen's body in the bathtub and placed his body back on the bed and caressed him, before masturbating over Stephen's body, not once, but twice. Nilsson waited until rigor mortis had begun and started setting in before he decided to get rid of Stephen's body. And when it does, he wraps him in plastic and he stows him beneath the flat's floorboards for almost 8 months. On August 11th, 1979, Nilsson built a bonfire in the garden behind his flat that only he and his former roommate had had access to, and he burned Stephen's body. Now, on October 11th of 1979, Nilsson lures Andrew Ho, a student from Hong Kong, back to his flat with the promise of sex. And when the two got back to Nilsson's flat, Nilsson attempted to strangle Andrew, but Andrew manages to fight Nilsson off and escapes the flat. And Andrew does report the incident to police, and Nilsson is questioned about the incident, but ultimately, like we see so often, and especially for this time in being a homosexual man, Andrew decided not to press charges against Nilsson. And just a few months later, on December 3rd of 1979, Nilsson meets 23-year-old Canadian student Kenneth Ockenden, who had been visiting relatives in England while he was out drinking in a pub in West End. And when Nilsson learns that Kenneth was a tourist, he quickly offers to show him around London and take him to some of the landmarks or sites that are frequented by tourists. And Kenneth agrees. The two head back to Nilsson's flat with the intent of having some food and continuing to drink. And while he's at the flat, he's listening to some music through a pair of headphones, and Nilsson comes up behind Kenneth and uses those very headphones to strangle him to death. Nilsson said he dragged Kenneth across the floor by the wire of the headphones while wrapped around his neck, and then proceeded, once he realized he was dead, to pour himself a glass of rum and put the very headphones that he had just used to take Kenneth's life back into his own ears and listen to some more music. The next day, Nilsson went out and bought a Polaroid camera, which he used to take several pictures of Kenneth's body in suggestive poses. And he then lays Kenneth's body. This is not my word, but they continue to use it throughout this article. Spread-eagled above him on his bed and proceeded to watch television for a few hours. After this, he wraps Kenneth's body in plastic bags and places him beneath the floorboards of his flat. But Nilsson was not done with Kenneth's remains, admitting that he dug him up at least four separate times and would seat Kenneth's corpse next to him on an armchair while he watched television and drank alcohol. Now, 16-year-old Martin Duffy, a catering student from Birkenhead, Merseyside, had hitchhiked to London without his parents' knowledge a few days prior after he was questioned by police for running out on his train fare. Martin had slept near a railroad station for almost 4 days when he met Nilsson, who was coming back from a union conference in Southport. Nilsson offered Martin a warm meal and a place to sleep, which Martin was more than happy to accept after he had been cold and hungry for the past 4 days. On the night of May 17th, 1980, after Martin fell asleep on his bed, Nilsson tied a ligature around his neck, sat on Martin's chest, and tightened the ligature with, quote, great force until Martin was unconscious. He then dragged Martin's body to the kitchen where he drowned him in the sink. Nilsson then bathed Martin's body, calling it the, quote, youngest looking I had ever seen. He first placed Martin's body on a kitchen chair and then moved it to the bed where he had just strangled him. Nielsen repeatedly kissed, complimented, and caressed Martin's body, both before and after he masturbated while sitting on the stomach of the corpse. Nielsen stored Martin's body in a cupboard for 2 days until he said he noticed the signs of decomposition, and after that, he said he immediately put Martin's body under the floorboards of his flat. After Martin Duffy's murder, Nielsen does not slow down at all. In fact, he begins escalating. Before the year 1980 is over, Nielsen would murder another 5 victims and attempt to murder a 6th. Only one of these victims, 26-year-old William David Sutherland, would ever be identified, although Nielsen could barely describe the unidentified victims. He had absolutely no issue recollecting the detail and the manner of their deaths and exactly how long he kept each body before he disposed of it. Nielsen recounted the way one victim moved his legs in a cycling motion while he strangled him to death, how he attempted to resuscitate another victim but was unsuccessful, which he said left him sobbing on his knees before standing up to spit at his own reflection in the mirror. Another time he described laying in bed next to the body of another unidentified victim as he listened to the classical theme fanfare for Common Man before he, quote, burst into tears. Now at this point, with 6 dead bodies beneath the floorboards of Nielsen's flat, of course the smell is becoming an extremely large issue, along with other things like insects and vermin, especially in the summer months when the heat comes in. After several occasions of Nielsen bringing bodies back up from under the floorboards, he began noticing maggots infesting the bodies, and he said crawling out of the victims' eye sockets and mouths. Nielsen attempted to remedy this by placing deodorants beneath the floorboards and spraying insecticide around his flat twice a day, but the odor and the flies remained. Obviously, you have dead bodies down there. Later the same year, Nielsen removed and dismembered each of the victims whose lives he'd taken since December of 1979, and he burned them on a communal bonfire that he had constructed himself. To cover up the obvious smell of burning human flesh, Nielsen topped the bonfire with an old car tire so that the smell of rubber would overpower the smell of his victims. Nielsen said that 3 neighborhood children watched the bonfire, and he later said he felt it would have seemed, quote, in order if he had seen the 3 children dancing around a mass funeral. After the bonfire, when all that was left of his victims was ashes and cinders, Nielsen sifted through the remains, searching for any intact bones, saying that all that remained was one human skull, which he quickly smashed to pieces with his rake and got rid of it. Now, around January of 1981, Nielsen meets an unidentified male that he describes as an 18-year-old blue-eyed Scot at the Garden Line pub in Soho. Nielsen invited him back to partake in a drinking game, which the man accepted. After Nielsen and the man had consumed a large amount of alcohol, Nielsen said that he strangled the victim with a necktie and placed his body under the floorboards. It is documented that Nielsen called in sick to work on January 12th, which he said he did that so that he could dismember both his victim and another unidentified victim that he had killed about a month prior. A few months later, by April, Nielsen had killed 2 further unidentified victims. One he described as an English skinhead that he met in a pub, and another he described as a, quote, Belfast boy, a man in his early 20s who was approximately 5'9" tall, and that he had murdered at some point in the month of February. While recounting the first of the three unidentified victims, Nilsson casually reflected and said, quote, "End of the day, end of the drink, end of a person. Floorboards back, carpet replaced, and back to work at Denmark Street." The following month, Nilsson dissected and removed the internal organs of several victims he had stored beneath the floorboards of his flat and discarded the internal organs both on the waste ground behind his flat and in his household rubbish. On the night of September 17th, 1981, Nilsson found 23-year-old Malcolm Barlow slumped against a wall outside of Nilsson's home. And when he approached Malcolm to see what was wrong, Malcolm told him that he had epilepsy and that the medication that he had taken had caused his legs to weaken and he couldn't walk anymore. Nilsson suggested that Malcolm be taken to a hospital, and he helped him up and let him into his home before calling for an ambulance, which he did do. He called an ambulance and they came and got Malcolm. And the next day, when Malcolm was released from the hospital, he returned to Melrose Avenue to Nilsson's flat to thank him for his help, at which point Nilsson invited him in for some food and drinks. After sharing a meal, the two men began drinking and Malcolm fell asleep on the sofa. While he slept, Nilsson strangled him to death and stored his body in a cabinet below his kitchen sink. Malcolm Barlow would be the last victim for Nilsson at the 195 Melrose Avenue home, because the landlord will decide that he wants to renovate the property, and he offers Nilsson 1,000 euros in exchange for Nilsson vacating the flat, to which Nilsson reluctantly agrees to. The day before he moves out, Nilsson dismembered and burned the bodies of the last five victims he had murdered, again disguising the smell with an old car tire. Now, Nilsson moved into an attic flat at 23 Cranley Gardens, where at this flat, he's unable to store bodies beneath any floorboards because he's on the top floor, and he had no access to a garden. So for nearly 2 months after the move, Nilsson did have several men come and go from the flat, but he didn't murder anybody. He recalls one encounter with a 19-year-old student named Paul Knobs that took place on November 23rd of 1981, where Nilsson attempted to strangle Paul, but Nilsson said that he stopped himself before any actual harm was done. In March of 1982, Nilsson met 23-year-old John Howlett while out drinking at a pub near Leicester Square. Nilsson invited John back to his flat to continue drinking, an offer that John accepted. John and Nilsson returned to the flat where they continued to drink and watch a movie until John wandered into the front room where Nilsson's mattress was at the time and fell asleep. About an hour later, Nilsson goes and attempts to rouse John, wake him up, for whatever reason, and this is unsuccessful. John is still asleep, and so Nilsson decides to keep drinking, and at this point he decides that he is going to kill him. And this murder would be more difficult than the previous victims because John fights back with everything he has, and he almost overpowers Nilsson, and he almost strangles Nilsson himself. Unfortunately, at some point, Nilsson gets the upper hand back and strangles John unconscious with an upholstery strap. Over the next 10 minutes, Nilsson would attempt three more times to strangle John, only to realize that John was still breathing. And at this point, he finally would take him back to the bathroom and drown him in the bathtub. For the next week, Nilsson's neck had bruising from the victim's hands, trying desperately to fight back. Less than 2 months later, in May of 1982, Nilsson met Carl Stotter, a 21-year-old gay man at the Black Cap Pub in Camden. Nilsson approached Carl and struck up a conversation with him where Carl opened up and revealed that he was depressed and heartbroken over a recent breakup he was going through. And after several more drinks, Nilsson invites Carl back to his flat, reassuring him that there's no strings attached. He doesn't want anything sexual from him, just to talk and have some drinks. After drinking further back at the flat, Carl falls asleep on a sleeping bag, only to wake up to Nilsson's body on top of his, strangling him and whispering loudly, "Stay still." Carl would later testify that he was confused when he awoke, first thinking that Nilsson was unzipping him from the sleeping bag he had fallen asleep on, only to lose consciousness again. When he woke again, he said he realized he was being submersed in water, and at this point he realized that Nilsson was trying to kill him. He barely gets his head above the water and yells, "No more, please, no more," only to be overpowered and pushed back under the water and lose consciousness yet again. Nilsson, believing at this point that he had successfully killed Carl, pulls him out of the tub and seats his body on an armchair. At this point, Nilsson's dog, Bleep, is his name, started licking Carl's face, and this strikes Nilsson as odd, and he realizes that Carl is actually still alive, but barely. And at this point, for some reason, Nilsson begins rubbing Carl's limbs and heart in an attempt to increase his circulation and fully resuscitate him. He then covers him in blankets and puts him on his bed. When Carl wakes up, Nilsson told him that he had almost strangled himself in the zipper of the sleeping bag, and that Nilsson had saved his life by resuscitating him. Carl would drift in and out of consciousness for two more days, and when he fully regains consciousness, Nilsson again tells him the story of the sleeping bag and explains that when Carl felt his body being submerged in water, it was because Nilsson believed him to be in shock and was trying to pull him out of it, whatever that means. Nilsson took Carl to the railway station that day and told him that he hoped they would see each other again. And thank God they don't, until Carl comes back to testify against Nilsson later. 3 months after Nilsson's promotion at work, in June of 1982, he met 27-year-old Graham Allen while attempting to hail a cab in Shaftesbury Avenue. Nilsson invited Allen to share a meal with him back at his flat. And once there, although he can't remember exactly when he decided to strangle Allen, he does recall approaching Allen while he was eating an omelet, intending on murdering him, which he does. He put Allen's body in a bathtub for 3 days before he began dissecting his body on the kitchen floor of his flat. And Nilsson is known to have called in sick to work again October 9th, 1982, which is believed to be the day that he dismembered Allen's body. Just a few short months later, in 1983, Nilsson would lure his last victim back to his flat. 20-year-old Stephen Sinclair fell asleep after being fed alcohol and drugs in an armchair of Nilsson's, listening to the rock opera Tommy. Nilsson said he approached Stephen, knelt down in front of him, and said to him, quote, "Oh, Stephen, here I go again," proceeding to strangle Stephen with a necktie and rope that he had fastened. Nilsson bathed Stephen's body and laid him on his bed, applied talcum powder to the corpse, then arranged three mirrors around the bed before laying down naked next to the body. Nilsson said he turned the head toward him, kissed him on the forehead, and said, quote, "Good night, Stephen," and fell asleep next to him. As with the two previous victims, Howlett and Allen, Stephen's body was dismembered, his body parts wrapped in plastic bags and stored in either a wardrobe, a tea chest, or within a drawer located under the bathtub. Nilsson attempted to dispose of the flesh, internal organs, and smaller bones from all three of the victims by flushing their remains down his toilet. In a ritual he had begun at his previous residence, he also boiled the heads, hands, and feet to remove the flesh off these sections of the victims' bodies. On February 4th of 1983, Nilsson wrote a letter to the estate agents for the flat that he was occupying, complaining that the drains at his Cranley Gardens flat had become blocked or clogged, and that it was making living at the residence intolerable for both him and for the other residents in the building. On February 8th, Michael Catran, a Dyno Rod employee, responded to the plumbing complaint made by both Nilsson and other tenants of the building. When he opened a drain cover at the side of the home, Catran discovers what appears to be a flesh-like substance packed into the drain with a number of small bones that he couldn't identify. Catran immediately reports this to his supervisor, Gary Wheeler, but since Catran hadn't arrived on the job until dusk that night, they agree to wait until the morning to investigate what exactly could be blocking these drains a little bit further. Nilsson actually interacts with Catran that night while he is on the property with a neighbor, and Catran discloses that whatever he found seems to be human flesh, to which Nilsson actually replied, quote, "It looks to me like someone has been flushing down their Kentucky Fried Chicken." Okay. At 7:30 a.m. the next morning, Catran returns to the property, this time with his manager, Wheeler, only to realize that the drain had been cleared already. Now, instead of this diverting them away, it actually only makes the two men even more suspicious of what Catran could have found the night before. And Catran later discovers some more scraps of flesh and four bones in a pipe leading directly from the drain, which was linked to the top flat of the house. Both men agree that the bones resemble that of a human hand, and they immediately contact the police. When the police arrive, they investigate further and they find more small bones and scraps of what appears to be human or animal flesh in the exact same drainage pipe. And when the police take these remains to a mortuary at Hornsey, pathologist Professor David Bowen advises the police that after he inspects everything, that the remains are in fact human, and that he even found what seemed to be a piece of flesh from a human neck with a ligature mark on it. When the police learn that the top flat belongs to none other than Dennis Nilsson himself, Detective Chief Inspector Peter Jay and two other officers decide to wait outside the home until Nilsson returns from work. When Nilsson gets home, DCIJ waiting outside introduces himself and the other two officers and explains that they're there investigating the blockage in the drains from his flat. Nilsson responds by asking why the police are interested in drains and asks if maybe they're from the health department or their health inspectors. And DCIJ informs Nilsson that they are in fact police officers, and he requests to access the flat so that they can discuss the matter further. Now, they say upon entering the flat, the police immediately get smacked in the face with the smell of human composition. And although Nilsson tries to divert their attention by asking more questions about why the police would be investigating a drain blockage, they tell him that the blockage was caused by human remains, and Nilsson acted shocked, saying, quote, "Good grief, how awful." In response, DCIJ, having none of this, says, "Don't mess about. Where's the rest of the body?" Nilsson immediately responds, calmly telling the officers that they could find the remains in plastic bags in a wardrobe. Now, the officers head over to the wardrobe, but they do not open it. They can already smell the overwhelming stench coming from the wardrobe, and they leave it be for the moment. Asking Nilsson if there were any other body parts to be found in the flat, Nilsson responds, "It's a long story. It goes back a long time. I'll tell you everything. I want to get it off my chest, not here at the police station." Nilsson is arrested and cautioned on suspicion of murder before he is taken to Hornsey Police Station. As he is being driven to the station, the police officer asks whether the remains belong to one person or two, to which Nilsson replies, 15 or 16 since 1978. That same night, Detective Superintendent Chambers, along with DCIJ and Professor Bowen, arrive at the Cranley Gardens flat, where they remove the plastic bags from the wardrobe and take them back to the Hornsey mortuary. One bag contained two dissected human torsos, a smaller bag contained various internal organs, another larger bag contained a human skull and a human torso with the arms still attached, but the hands missing. Both heads were found to have been subjected to moist heat, likely from being boiled. In an interview with police on February 10th, Nilsson confessed that there were even more human remains in his home, stowed in a tea chest in his living room and inside an upturned drawer in his bathroom. The dismembered body parts belonged to three men, all of which were strangled to death. One victim he could not name, another he referred to as John the Guardsman, and the third he successfully identified as Stephen Sinclair, his last victim. He also confessed to police that beginning in December of 1978, he had killed, quote, 12 or 13 men at the previous residence on Melrose Avenue. Nilsson further confessed to attempting to kill approximately seven other people, all whom had escaped, and one that he had revived and allowed to leave the residence. In an additional search at the Cranley Gardens residence on February 10th, police find a lower section of a torso and two legs hidden in a bag in the bathroom, a skull, a section of another torso, and various bones in the tea chest. That same day, Nilsson accompanied police to his former residence on Melrose Avenue and showed them the three locations in the back garden where he had burned the remains of his other victims. That same day, the employee who had initially called the police after discovering the human remains in the drain blockage, Michael Catran, offered or contacted the Daily Mirror and informed the press that the police were in an ongoing search for human remains at Cranley Gardens. And by February 12th, Dennis Nilsson is front page news. Now, under English law, the police have 48 hours to charge someone with a crime or they have to release them. Assembling the remains of the victims killed at Cranley Gardens on the floor of the Hornsey Mortuary, Professor Bowen was able to confirm the fingerprints on one body matched those on police records for Stephen Sinclair, corroborating Nilsson's confession. And on February 11th at 5:40 p.m., police officially charged Nilsson with Sinclair's murder and released a statement to the press. Formal questioning of Nilsson began immediately, and Nilsson finally agreed to be represented by a solicitor, or what we call lawyer here in the U.S., which he had earlier declined. Police would question Nilsson 16 separate times over the following days, totaling in over 30 hours of interviews. Nilsson never gave a motive for the killings, telling the police that he was hopeful they would be able to explain that to him after he confessed. He claimed that he never planned the murders beforehand, stating that he only decided mere moments before he was going to kill someone. Most of his victims had died from strangulation, a few he had drowned after strangling them into unconsciousness. Once the victims were dead, he would bathe them, shave their torso, and apply makeup to any obvious blemishes on the skin. He would usually dress the body in underpants and socks before Nilsson would drape the lifeless body around himself and talk to them. Nilsson said he would masturbate as he stood by or knelt over the body, and he confesses to having occasionally engaged in non-penetrative sex, where he would place his genitalia in between the thighs of the deceased and do what he did. He was adamant that he never penetrated any of the victims, saying that his victims were, quote, too perfect and beautiful for the pathetic ritual of commonplace sex. At his Melrose Avenue residence, Nilsson admitted to keeping the bodies for as long as decomposition would allow, saying that he would frequently pull the bodies back up from underneath the floorboards if it did not show signs of serious decomposition so that he could masturbate over the body again. Makeup was always reapplied to the victims in these circumstances to hide any further blemishes and, quote, enhance its appearance. When questioned about the moist heat that victims' heads had been exposed to, Nilsson admitted to boiling the heads in a large cooking pot on his stove so that the brain and flesh would evaporate, eliminating the need for him to dispose of them. The torsos and limbs of the three victims killed at Cranley Gardens residence had been dissected within a week or so of their murder before he would wrap them in plastic bags and stow them in the three locations throughout his home that he had previously pointed out to police. The internal organs and smaller bones were flushed down his toilet, which led to the clogging of the pipes and eventually led to his arrest. He said that this was the only method he could think of to dispose the internal organs and soft tissue since he had no longer had exclusive access to the garden like he had at his previous residence. When police asked Nilsson if he felt any remorse for what he had done, he replied, quote, I wish I could stop, but I couldn't. I had no other thrill or happiness. He also said that he took no pleasure in the act of killing, but, quote, worshipped the art and act of death. That sounds to me like you take pleasure in the act of killing. But okay. On February 11th, 1983, Nilsson was officially charged with the murder of Stephen Sinclair and was transferred to HMP Brixton to be held on remand until his trial. Nilsson said that he felt relief upon being transferred to Brixton Prison, believing that he would be viewed as innocent until proven guilty. He objected to wearing a prison uniform while he was on remand, which is required, and to protest wearing a uniform, he decided that he would refuse to wear any clothes at all. And as a result of this, he was not allowed to leave his cell. On August 1st, Nilsson threw the contents of his cell toilet out of his cell, hitting not one but several officers. And as a result of this, he was found guilty on August 9th of assaulting prison officers, and he spent 56 days in solitary confinement for that. On May 26th, the next year, Nilsson was set to stand trial at the Old Bailey, being charged with 5 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder. A 6th murder charge was later added as well. Throughout the trial, Nilsson was represented by Ronald Moss, or before the trial, he was represented by Ronald Moss, who he had fired and rehired several times. Initially, Nilsson was intending to plead guilty to all charges of murder. And with Nilsson's consent, Ronald Moss had fully prepared his defense. But just 5 weeks before the trial was set to begin, Nilsson once again fired Moss and replaced him with Ralph Hines, at which point he was convinced by Ralph to plead not guilty by diminished responsibility, which basically means he is claiming that he is not fully responsible for the crimes committed because he was mentally impaired or mentally unfit to be fully responsible. Nilsson's trial began on October 24th of 1983. Again, he's being charged with 6 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder, all of which he's pleading not guilty to. The main argument between the defense and the prosecution was not whether or not Nilsson had committed the crimes, but his state of mind before and during the crimes. Prosecution argued that Nilsson was completely sane, in control of his actions, and that he had premeditated the murders, while the defense argued that Nilsson suffered from diminished responsibility, rendering him incapable of forming the intention to commit murder, and therefore he should only be convicted of manslaughter. Throughout the trial, the prosecution brought forward men that Nilsen had attempted to murder to testify. The defense brought in psychiatrists to testify that Nilsen had a lack of emotional development and that he had difficulty expressing any emotion other than anger. Following closing arguments from the prosecution and the defense, the jury retired to consider the verdict on November 3rd of 1983. The next day, the jury came back with a majority verdict of guilty upon 6 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted to murder, with a unanimous verdict of guilty in relation to the attempted murder of Nobbs. Nilsen was sentenced to life in prison with a recommendation that he serve a minimum of 25 years. Later, this would be amended to a full life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. In the following years, throughout his incarceration, Nilsen composed an unpublished 400-page autobiography titled The History of a Drowning Boy. Nilsen's first murder victim was later identified as 14-year-old Stephen Holmes, who was previously unidentified. At least 4 victims killed between 1980 and 1981 at Melrose Avenue remain unidentified. Several items confiscated from Nilsen's Cranley Gardens address are on display at New Scotland Yard's Crime Museum, including the stove he used to boil the heads of his final victims, the knives he had used to dissect several of his victims' bodies, and the very headphones he had used to strangle Kenneth to death, the ligature he had fashioned to strangle his last victim, and the bathtub from his Cranley Gardens home in which he had drowned Howlett and retained the body of Alan prior to dissecting it. On May 10th of 2018, Nilsen was taken from HMP Full Sutton to York Hospital after complaining of severe stomach pains. They found he had a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, which the doctors took him into surgery and repaired, but ultimately he suffered a blood clot from this operation. And on May 12th of 2018, Dennis Nilsen died from a pulmonary embolism and hemorrhage. Nilsen was cremated on June of 2018 and no family members attended his service. In January of 2021 this year, a former confidant of Nilsen's, Mark Austin, revealed that that the unedited version of The History of a Drowning Boy was set to be published by Red Door Press. The autobiography, based on 6,000 pages of typewritten notes Nilsen had authored himself while incarcerated, examines his life and crimes and was edited by Austin, who had actually become a pen pal of Nilsen's in the years prior to Nilsen's death. They had exchanged more than 800 letters. The autobiography was released in February 2021. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Now through July 1st, I'm doing a giveaway. If you leave a 5-star review for the podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts, just screenshot it and send me a DM on Instagram with the screenshot. You can find me on Instagram at True Crime Cases Pod. And you will be entered to win $100 cash. Once again, this giveaway will close on July 1st, and I will leave my Instagram username and all of our social media in the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also find all of the sources that I used for this episode in the show notes as well. And I will be back next Tuesday with a brand new episode. Thank you.